This is the Dungeon Master Guys.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of the Dungeon Master Guide. I'm your host, Philippe Antoine Ménard, known as the Chatty DM, co-hosting with my good friend Dave the Game Chalker. Hey Dave, how you doing?
Oui.
Croissant. Not too tired from your convention period?
Conventions are almost always fun. My last one is a bit of an exception, but I'm not quite done for the year yet either. I've got DC Game Day coming up, which I'm looking forward to. I'm good to go.
All right. And also co-hosting our show is now legendary newbie no more, newbie DM. How you doing, man?
How you guys doing? You brought me out of the dungeon.
Yes, because you've been good. I've heard very nice things about you at Gen Con.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, Gen Con was a fun time. It was, yeah. I got to sit with you DMing one of those, Scars of Chaos adventures?
I ran you through the Chaos Scar adventure, The Lost Library.
It was really fun. It went so fast. I didn't see time go by. I was pretty sure we had played for like 2 hours, and it's been what, 4 or 5 hours?
Yeah, it was like a 4 or 4.5 hour game. It was fun though.
Awesome game. It made me want to play D&D more than DM it for in the next few months or so. It's a very good compliment, and I kind of miss playing D&D very much so. So we have a great show for you today. We're going to start out with an interview I did with Luke Crane at Gen Con, where we discussed what a GM could learn at Gen Con. Then we're going to... Newbie, you talked to Mike Shea about epic level gaming. So we're going to listen to that. And at the end, Dave and I got to sit down with legendary killer DM Chris Perkins, where he discusses his rep and also his bad mapping skills.
That sounds like a pretty epic show, Phil. But you know what else is pretty epic?
What is, man?
Our sponsor, Obsidian Portal.
Oh, yeah.
Too many NPCs to manage? Players can't remember what happened at the last session? Wasting valuable game time flipping through your notebook trying to find some detail you wrote down months ago? Running a tabletop campaign is hard, but Obsidian Portal makes it easy. With Obsidian Portal, you can manage your tabletop RPG campaign online. Our tools let you track NPCs, locations, items, events, and every other detail for your game. Sign up for free at obsidianportal.com and use promo code DMGUYS to get a bonus.
And thank you to our sponsors, Obsidian Portal.
All right, so let's start with our first segment, where I got to sit down with Luke Crane and discuss the various things that a GM could learn with a Gen Con experience.
All right, I'm here with Luke Crane, the designer of The Burning Wheel and Mouse Guard and just released Free Market. And I wanted to ask him a very specific question about what can GMs learn from Gen Con?
So I've been coming to Gen Con since 2003, my 7th or 8th Gen Con, and I've been running events religiously, as it were, since day one. I book them in a schedule, people sign up, and I had never done that before I started coming to cons. Gen Con is kind of the big dog, right?
Yes.
Gen Con, you get people from all over the country. It's not a local con where it's just local gaming groups or whatnot. So one of the things I found is that most everyone at Gen Con is cool, and there's no reason to be shy as a GM. There's no reason to be nervous or shy. Everyone comes to your table and wants to buy in, wants to have a good time. So once I got over that initial shyness and reticence and said, oh wait, these people are actually interested, it really kind of opened me up and relaxed me and let me kind of push them a little bit more. And in fact, push them more than I would push my home gaming group, right? Because my home gaming group would never let me get away with some of the stuff that I do. They'd be like, Luke, you can't do that. These guys don't know me. We have a different relationship, right? We have almost a formal relationship here. Like, you are the players. I am the GM. I'm going to, present you with challenges. We are going to attempt to overcome these these challenges.
Yes.
And so, but so that kind of the formality allows me to pull off some crazy shit, and they love it. Like last night, we had a total party kill.
In your killer dungeon.
In my killer dungeon, and they were having a great time. You know, at home when they had a total party kill, they never wanted to play with each other again. So it's just, I find that basically I get to take all of the good stuff from each player. I get to kind of experience a new relationship, see different perspectives on games and on how stuff is played, and it really ups my skills.
So you think that GMs that can come to Gen Con should try to run games, and they'll learn a lot from being exposed to other people because it's so cool, but they're different from their players.
Yeah.
Oh, nice, cool.
You learn new things. You learn new techniques. You kind of forget your bad habits.
Yes.
Because you're like, oh, well, that thing that I do, oh, that's just because that's the way we do it at home, not because it's necessary.
Oh, yeah. Cool. That's cool. All right. And now, second question is, what would GMs gain from exploring indie games? I'm talking about more traditional GMs that haven't tried indie games so far.
What's an indie game?
That's a very good question, but let's just say games that do not fit in, I would say, the top 70% of the market. So I'd say Pathfinder, Dungeons & Dragons, and White Wolf games, and, you know, Heroes and Gurse would be my top five.
So there's kind of two or three models of role-playing games out there. There are games where you have a very traditional power structure that was born in the medium in the 70s,
yes,
where you have a patriarchal GM who controls the story. It's the GM's story, and the players are reacting to the GM's story. Then you have new school games, which it's codified into the rules, the powers of the GM, and how much input the GM gives, how much input the players give. And it doesn't necessarily mean the GM isn't pushing or challenging or isn't a forceful entity, but there's it creates a different dynamic. I found with players who play my stuff or, you know, when I play other stuff, I find that it kind of opens up the channels in your brain.
Mind blowing is an expression I hear a lot when people try to.
Nah, fuck mind blowing.
Okay.
Fuck that. You realize that there's a lot more to the medium. The medium of role play is not just this one relationship that I have with my GM. That it's, in fact, that role playing games are this beautiful, art form that can take many different faces, and you can be many different ways to play it. And it's not just one thing.
Totally.
That's just good. It's like finding new music. It's like, you know, reading a kind of book you've never read before, or seeing a movie that challenges you, that says, wow, that was weird and different, but I like that. So by playing these other games, and playing games that are essentially experimental, especially the micro-press stuff, you can see whole new takes on the medium, and it just really broaden your mind and become a better consumer.
All right, very good. And I got to experience your last game yesterday at Free Market. I was amazed. It was really, really cool, this science fiction game. Why don't you tell us about it?
So in that game, just to carry the topic forward, the GM is very forceful in that game. But the one key thing, right, it's as a GM, I am shoving stuff in your face. But the stuff that I shove in your face is the stuff that you guys give me to start, right? You guys give me your memories, then I scramble the memories up and start throwing them back at you in bits and pieces. So one, it's incredibly easy to run.
It is.
As the GM. Like, you know.
So it seems like.
You saw me a couple times. I had to, like, kind of go into, like, full processing mode and be like, how am I going to do this? But all the pieces are right there. And since you guys wrote out these memories, and your guys are like, I don't know what this is for, but I'll bite, I'll try it. But since you guys wrote it out, you're invested. Like, as soon as I said, like, oh, it's this person or this place, everyone's...
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm involved now.
Yeah, you're like, when the dreadful memories kept coming up, you were like, oh, geez.
Right? Something bad's going to happen.
So it's... I did that on purpose. I wanted to share the load. It's hard to be the GM. It's hard to navigate everyone's priorities at the table and make it your story, you know, and be dealing with the rules, right? And be, you know, the arbiter of the rules. So in this one, in this game, it's not your story. It's their story, and you're saying, oh yeah, it's your story. Well, what about this? What about this? What about this? You know, and you're challenging them with the things that they said, they claimed they were interested in. And we found that players love it. Players love to have their dead cat reappear in somebody else's arms alive now, right? Their cat they had a memory about, or, you know, someone from their past comes back and says, oh, I need a favor. I mean, it's a classic trope, right? On one hand, and on the other hand, it's a mind fuck. So it sets the tone for the game. It makes it very easy to run as a GM. It's fun. It turned out, holy cow, we made something fun.
And it totally was. And I'm really looking forward to see how, when people will start talking about it online as they play it and as they play campaigns of it, to see how it's going to turn out.
I am dying.
Let's see how the donut grows in each other's hands, other GM's hands.
I want to know about your donut, Alexander's donut, you know, and how it's different from my donut.
This is so wrong. Thank you very much, Luke.
Always a pleasure, sir.
Thanks.
And that was my discussion with Luke Crane about what a GM can learn at Gen Con and what a GM can learn about indie games. So, newbie, what about you? I heard that you sat down with Mike Shea to talk about something special, right?
Yeah, I sat down with Mike to talk about Epic Level tier play, only because I was at the product launch for Wizards of the Coast at Gen Con. I asked about Epic Level support, Epic tier support for DMs, and their answer was that basically, not yet, because not too many groups are playing Epic tier games. And I thought that I'm sure there are plenty of groups out there playing Epic tier games, and they're not really being supported by the official channels, so they have to turn to people like Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com for that support. On the internet, he's one of the top guys to get tips from when it comes to Epic tier play, and I talked to him about that and see what it is that he does for his group. So let's listen in.
All right, I'm here with Mike Shea from the wonderful SlyFlourish.com blog. And Mike, I know you've been running an Epic tier campaign for a while now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So we've actually been running our campaign since Keep of the Shadowfell came out, which is about 2.5, I think it's about 2.5 years ago. It was before there was a Player's Handbook 1, 2, and 3. And ever since I was a kid, I always loved Orcus as a villain. So the whole campaign for 2.5 years has been basically coming down to the party hunting down and stopping all of Orcus's evil plots, from, you know, small priests underneath the Keep of the Shadowfell all the way through to high priests and further off places. So I believe we hit the Epic tier near the beginning of the year, since, like, I think about February we were running. It was the first time that we hit Epic. And my group is now they're level 28 now. I think about 8 sessions left before the end of this campaign, and it's been pretty wild.
That's funny, because when I was at the Wizards new product seminar, I asked a question about when would the Dungeon Master's Guide 3 come out, because you would assume that the Dungeon Master's 3 would lead us into the Epic tier and give us advice, and their answer was that not a lot of groups are in the Epic tier, and they don't see a need to support the Epic tier just yet. And here you are. And I feel that the Epic tier is the tier with the least amount of support coming out of Wizards. What do you think?
So I'm not surprised that not a lot of people are running Epic tier. My experience has been that not a lot of people are running Epic tier. And I mean, I have been very, very lucky to have a group that wanted to play every week for 2.5 years straight without changing campaigns, without getting bored and saying they wanted to start over somewhere else. And I've been pretty adamant about running through it. So
that probably says a lot about your DMing, by the way.
we could hope. But nobody said, hey, we want to start over with Eberron, or we want to start with, you know, Forgotten. I mean, Eberron and Forgotten Realms came out in the middle of my campaigns. And I just said, wow, these look really great. I'll set them aside and we'll get to them when I'm done, you know, with this campaign. And now Dark Sun is out. So there's now been 3 campaign settings that have come out since I've started my campaign. There's a fair amount of Epic tier stuff, but I'd probably say I haven't seen it. It's not real balanced, or a lot of it isn't real balanced. And I've watched it evolve over the past 3 monster manuals. And I think they're really starting to get it right. Although I think even the Monster Manual 3 guys still need some work. But you know, the biggest change over that time period was monster damage, which was pretty woefully lacking, even in Paragon. And certainly through Epic, it was just not, the amount of damage that monsters put out was not nearly enough. to threaten a party.
All right, so let's get down to what I want to talk about. If I'm running an epic tier game, which I'm not, I haven't gotten to epic tier, but let's say I was, what are some of the things that you need to look out for when you're DMing epic tier that you're not going to find published in a magazine or a book? What are the things that you've learned from experience?
Well, I think that Wizards in the DMG 1 and 2 really talked about the storyline, so I won't talk too much about it. But the main thing that I keep in mind is that they're really superheroes at this point, that they can, you know, they can fly. I mean, it's like, how would you write an adventure for Superman as one of the main characters? I mean, you really have to expect that the players and that the PCs just have powers way beyond anything that any mortal would have. So making sure that the storyline matches that, you know, it should almost... I mean, mine had no doubt mine was going to be in the outer planes at Epic Tier and in the deep outer planes. We're talking, they spend a lot of time in the elemental chaos and now they're spending a lot of time in the abyss. And, you know, there's just no way they'd bother to go back to mortal worlds. And there's no threat on a mortal world that they would face that would threaten them at all. So storyline, that's where I've been keeping it. So the question, your question was, what are the main things someone should keep in mind when they're
What are things that you've noticed that as a DM you really need to keep an eye out on to make sure that your game doesn't suffer from the fact that these players have all this power?
Right. I mean, you need to beat the hell out of your players. You know, I have this you know rule that you be nice and heroic, be even handed in Paragon, and be a real bastard in Epic, because there's just no, you know. The kind of stuff that you see, the kind of combinations of powers and everything that players get, that PCs get at the epic line is so crazy that, I mean, I've seen solos die in 9 turns, you know, after 9 character actions. You know, they did 900 damage in 2 rounds. And I've seen single elite monsters that were completely incapacitated on the first hit and never recovered until they were dead. So there's a lot of craziness that can go on there, and the way to fight the craziness is, you know, throw a lot of stuff at them. Never run a solo by itself. I've done that, and I made this mistake like last week, you know, so I continually make this mistake thinking now I've figured out a way to run a solo that's not going to get beat, and then it gets immediately beat. So there's a lot of things that you have to keep in mind, and you know, the main thing is that an epic tier game is really hard to run. It's been, you know, significantly more challenging for me to build a game that's fun for players, where the time at the table does not take too long, where they're not bored, and where the challenge is high. You know, I think at the heroic tier, it's a lot easier. I've run a bunch of heroic games recently, and it is much easier to run a heroic game and keep the balance right and everything like that than it is to run
epic tier. I love heroic tier.
Yeah, it's great. And it's, you know, it's fun, it's fat. I mean, when you run a bunch of epic games in a row, and then you run a heroic game, the heroic game is a lot of fun. I mean, it's fast. You know, the monsters are balanced. The damage is right. The players aren't pulling. They don't have so many options that it takes them forever to figure out what they want to do. So, I mean, the heroic tier is really great. But on the other hand, you can't fight 2 Balors in the heroic tier.
Right.
You know, and that's what I love about Epic. You know, I want to see, you know, young dragons don't excite me nearly as much as great worms do. And, you know, the boss of the local gang is not anything like Orcus. So that's why I like Epic Tier so much, is now they can really just fight everything. So
let me ask you something. When you're running an Epic Tier game, have you seen I want to talk a little bit about the speed of the game at Epic Tier. Are you running 1 combat per night, or does it not slow down as much? How does that work? What's your
experience? Well, so there's 2 things. One is, and you know, just to diverge for a second. On one side, I think that running an epic tier one-shot game is probably something everybody should do. But if you're ever planning on running epic, you should run a couple of one-shot games early on to get an idea of what it's going to be like. That said, those games are not necessarily going to run great. So you want to be prepared early to see what epic is going to look like. I ran a couple of epic level games, you know, within the first year, and I immediately saw, wow, these guys just don't do enough damage and these battles are taking forever. So when you start to see that early, you start to understand where you're going to have to go when you actually hit epic. I don't think that the battles necessarily, I've seen some really long heroic tier battles that have gone, and I've seen some really fast epic tier battles. I think a lot of that has to do with being a DM. And I know that I have to be absolutely ruthless as a DM to keep people moving along. And I mean, almost to the point of rudeness. Like, I mean, I'm not yelling at people, but I'm making it clear to them, look, you have to make a decision in the next few seconds or I'm going to move on. And you have to do that constantly. So I've seen some DMs at the heroic tier who are kind of laid back and relaxed and kind of letting people, you know, hem and haw about what they want to do. And I've seen these heroic battles go on for 2 hours because of that. So your original question is how many do I run? I usually run about 2 encounters a night, and that's in about 3-3.5 hours. And that can include some storyline in the beginning and middle and end. And that's pretty comfortable depending on the battle. If I'm going to run a really big battle, like I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, they fought Dorisane the Ghoul King, who again, if you want to see a weak epic tier monster, look at Dorisane in the D&D compendium and you'll see a guy that's going to get killed in one round easily. So I rebuilt him into a solo that actually mirrored one of the Dark Sun solos. And or it took abilities from the Dark Sun solo, but he was much more powerful. So it was a solo, one elite, and a ton of minions, and a crazy environment. Like, it was a swimming pool full of ghouls, essentially. And that battle I knew was going to go on for a long time. So I planned just that one battle for that night. And it took about 2 hours for that battle, but it gave people a lot of, you know, freedom to enjoy it. I didn't have to push people real hard. And it ended up working out pretty well. But for my Wednesday game this week, I'm planning 3 battles in one night. So I'll let you know how that goes and whether or not we're going to get through 3 battles at level 28 in 3.5 hours. And they're big battles. They're not small.
So what does a epic level character look like? Is he walking through a metal detector and setting it off because of all his magical items?
Items are out of hand. You know, I'm really glad to hear about the new item rarity thing. I don't think that items alone, you know, create these crazy kind of jumps in character power, but they don't help. I've been lucky that Matt James is one of my players. He's one of my newer players. So he's been starting off with some level 28 or level 27, level 28 guys that he built himself. And when he gets to pick his items, he gets to pick the items based around the feats and powers that his character has. So if he knows that his guy is going to get a lot of crits, then he specifically picks high crit weapons and items that trigger off of crits and things like that. So you get a lot of combinations of item powers that mix in with everything else. The other thing is resistances. I have to assume, in fact, I told, you know, through the storyline, I said, look, if you guys are going to Thanatos, you know, the layer of the abyss that is owned by Orcus, I mean, it's essentially an entire world of undead. You have to have at least 10 necrotic resistance or you will fall over dead the second you set foot on the ground. And so all of them have at least 10 resist necrotic 10, which means I know that they have that. So now I can kind of tune things a little bit differently to make sure that when there are guys who only do necrotic resistance, that they do enough to still threaten the party, but still make it feel like they're resisting something.
Well, thanks for coming on the Dungeon Master, guys. And, you know, you have a permanent spot here whenever you want it.
Oh, thank you very much.
And good luck with your game. And let us know when you finish a campaign to 30th, when you get to 30th.
Yep, we're looking about November.
When you send your guys off on their epic destinies, let us know what happens. Keep us informed. Exactly. All right, you can find Mike at slyflourish.com and on twitter.com/slyflourish.
So that was Mike Shea with his tips for epic tier play. And Dave, you had a chance to speak to an epic DM.
I did. Phil and I sat down with Chris Perkins, also known as the DM to the Stars at Gen Con. We wanted to kind of call him out on his reputation as a killer DM because Phil and I really don't have that style at all. And so we really wanted to grill him about that, although I think you'll find that he might have a few surprises, so let's take a listen.
All right, so we're here with Chris Perkins, legendary Dungeon Master working at Wizards of the Coast, and we thought it'd be interesting to discuss the art of Dungeon Mastering, how he got into Dungeon Mastering, and especially explore his Killer Dungeon persona.
Yes,
Killer Dungeon
Master. We have a lot of questions about that, I think.
I am harmless.
So Chris, why don't you tell us how you became a DM?
I became a DM mostly out of necessity because the game group I grew up with consisted of a very small number of folks. None of the other guys wanted to do the job. So I kind of got thrust into it, but that's fine. I always considered myself a creative guy, a world builder. So I gravitated toward that immediately.
How old were you?
I was 12 when I first started playing. Had no idea what I was doing. And had really no idea how to create a story or a good adventure or any of that stuff. It was just, let's just throw some random crap together and see how long it takes to kill you.
Do you have any good horrible early Dungeon Master stories, like something particularly bad that you like cringe when you remember?
It's positive dogs with them.
I remember the very first dungeon I built, which was this Gygaxian monstrosity that ate up every square inch of the graph paper I was using. And basically, in order to stock the dungeon, I went through the monster manual alphabetically. So, the first monsters you fought were like Aerial Servant, Giant Ant, Pompeg, and it literally was in order, and I paid no heed to the levels of the monsters. So the characters are going through and just getting annihilated.
Was it a dungeon of like an insane librarian or something?
I don't remember the backstory. It was something pretty trite and obvious. And no internal logic to the dungeon whatsoever.
So those are the best years.
Yes. Those were good times. We went through a lot of characters. Back then the characters were not that substantive, so you know, you lost the whole party. You could just roll up a new party in about 30 minutes and keep going.
But you were a killer DM even back then, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. But I'm much more experienced now.
Right.
Now I kill my players in actual, you know, interesting story-related ways.
Right.
It doesn't seem so arbitrary.
But clearly, even though you started out of necessity and maybe had a rocky start, you kept with it for a long time, right?
Yes.
So what is it that kind of kept you in games? Like, what really kind of pulled you in to keep DMing for a long time?
Mostly it was I was very much into just Dungeons & Dragons. I was buying all the stuff that TSR was putting out, and for me it was a way to legitimize those purchases. Spending all that money as a kid, I needed to figure out, okay, how can I actually use all this stuff? I was always thinking about adventures all through school, you know, during math class or whatever. I would sit at the back of the room and just draw maps and think about adventures.
I used to do that too.
Yeah. It was a great preoccupation during my school years. And I started to come up with so many stories and so many adventure ideas that I'd never be able to use them all. But I think a lot of it too is just fueled by the players I had. We were a very dedicated group. We played all the time, and they were always hungry for more. They always wanted to know what was coming up next. Occasionally, I branch off and we do other campaign settings for a while, but mostly I stop with the core.
All right, so you've got a reputation on the internet and all around that you're kind of a killer DM, and all the, you know, probably all the fans of Will Wheaton ate you. But the thing is for many DMs, being a badass with the fourth edition is not that easy. I've never played a game ever since it's gone out, and I've never actually killed a player, not for lack of trying. So is there a mindset, or I get a feeling from people playing your campaigns and play through the podcast that the group goes through characters, or at least characters. But what is the ingredient to, you know, badass DM?
Wow, that's a good one. Although people joke that I'm a killer DM, in the games that I run, and I run two games set in the same campaign on Mondays and Wednesdays, with pretty big groups, like there's 7 and 8 players.
Ooh,
basically.
Wow.
So already it's sort of stacked. There's a great need for me to kind of take our typical encounter formats and stretch them out a little and make them more challenging for the bigger group. But that said, over the course of these campaigns, which have been running since the start of 4th edition, I've probably killed off maybe 6 characters in 2 years. Which isn't horrible.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that's a lie.
In like campaigns specifically?
In the campaign specifically, that's not including 2 TPKs. But I'll get back to those in a second.
There's always a story.
Yes. And more often than not, the reason those characters die is either because it's the unhappy marriage of bad dice rolls coupled with 1 or 2 poor decisions, tactical decisions. Like the character got separated from the party somehow and didn't have access to their heals or whatever. It wasn't like they just dropped from maximum hit points to 0 hit points instantly. It was always like they just were in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong dice. And that's what did them in. That said, I have no compunctions about throwing like scores of minions on the table. I have no compunctions about giving them an encounter with a monster a couple levels higher than them. But really, it comes down to just the bad dice rolls and just unfortunate tactics.
But if you'll allow, is there a mindset that makes you? I mean,
I am never, when I sit down to a game, thinking, "Oh, I'm gonna knock off someone today," or "I'm gonna."
Let's reverse that. Is there a certain point in your game where you will lower your level of meanness or
color?
Because that's something I would tend to do. Yeah. When my players hit the whole crap stage,
when they hit the whole crap stage, I feed off that. I get really excited by that. I want to see them squirm a little bit. I'm not going to make it easy on them. I'm not going to make it hard, because I know if things go horribly awry, I'll find some way out of it. But no, I don't temper the game down just because it looks like they're having a hard time.
So you keep your constant, pressure's always constant.
Yeah, pressure.
And
sometimes they're really good about adding their own pressure to situations just by the choices that they make. And I just love that. I love when they get really antsy, when they get scared, when it looks like that the party could just get completely wiped out in a round or two. Because about 75 to 90% of the time, they figure out a way to turn it around. You know, they start looking at their character sheets for those things that they, for the way out. Like, what do I have? What do I have? Do we have this? And I love sitting back and watching that happen.
It's a great part.
Yeah,
so you'd say that throwing those challenges, that it can kind of force them to be more creative,
yes.
And it kind of brings out a lot of that.
Yes.
Do you find that it goes beyond just like, okay, here are my powers, how can I use these in a combo way that, you know, they may have done before, or do you find that they actually will pull out like stuff in the environments? Like,
They'll start asking questions about the room that they're in or the area that they're in, if there's anything that they can use when they get desperate like that. Yeah. Now, the two cases where we had TPKs in my campaign were, one was during an adventure that had a time travel element to it, so there was an out. They got wiped out, but then time sort of reset and everything was fine, so I guess you can't really count that, although it did scare the bejesus out of me. And then the other one was a situation where they were basically, where I decided that they didn't all have to. One of the interesting things about 4th edition is the whole knock you unconscious mechanic. They basically staged an assault on a magical weapons factory, basically. And things went horribly, horribly awry, but rather than kill them off, I just had the NPCs, when they dropped to zero, you know, knock them out, which of course precipitated an entire new kind of series of adventures where they had to extricate themselves from the situation they'd gotten themselves in. They were branded as criminals, they were locked aboard a slave ship, they were on their way to an island prison, and the whole getting out of that situation became a very interesting adventure.
So, at the table itself, like when that happened, like, had you planned, like, this is a possibility if they fail, and so then you were able to kind of roll?
I was pretty sure they would succeed.
Oh, okay.
So I hadn't set up anything in advance.
So that sort of ended the adventure.
When things started to fall apart, when suddenly they weren't coming together as a team, they were becoming separated, they were falling down, dropping like flies. While they were struggling with that, I was having another moment in my head, which was, okay, looks like they're not going to get out of this.
Right.
What am I going to do? And it was, okay, I don't want to kill them off here. I want to make them suffer for a while for this misfortune. But I'm going to set something up, introduce some new villains that would potentially haunt them later. Because it's characters, when they face a villain and they lose, you don't want it to end there. If the campaign ends there, there's no payoff. The villain doesn't get the comeuppance. But out of that, I got some really good bad guys who, when they had to finally get out of their situation and then go back and fight later, they had this whole level of hatred that wasn't there before.
It has been very satisfying for the players.
It was.
All right. I'll just go back to character death, because you actually had a few, and I believe that some of the DMs go soft when it starts to be dicey, because they fear the social implications on their group of having a character die, especially when they're lower level, you know, like end of heroic, where resurrection magic is not as easy to get by. So Do you live through a few character deaths? I mean, how do the players take it?
Generally speaking, they take it okay because most of the players I play with enjoy the process of coming up with character concepts and character ideas. They're not afraid to start over.
Particularly, they start over. They don't necessarily get their characters back?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
In a couple cases, it's been like, okay, that character was interesting, but maybe I'm happy to try something else, or there's this new class or this new race or there's something I want, a new toy I want to play with. So here's just an obvious opportunity to segue into something new. So I've got the group of players that I generally play with are of that mindset that they're ready, they're happy to try something new. On occasion, there will be an odd player character who invested enough in the backstory of the character that they'd like to find a way to continue that character, and then usually I'll try to work something out with them. Either the characters have some sort of patron that they can go to and ask a favor, which, by the way, is a great setup for future adventures.
Right.
Even if the characters can't afford to bring their character back or don't have the means, if the DM can find a logical way within the story to have the characters meet somebody who can help them do that, get their dead friend back, then sometime future in the campaign,
that's going to be called for.
Yeah, and that's always fun.
Yeah, see, that's often my problem with killing players and not players. That's an easy mistake.
And it's never an easy favor.
Yeah.
It's always something that goes, oh man, why did we bring you back? Kind of like one of those fun moments.
Especially when it's called in.
It's the devil's due, you know? Yeah. It's like, oh my gosh.
Cool.
But so, like, I get invested in people's characters too.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I can be pretty
sometimes you build like stories or arcs.
Yeah, exactly. I feel pretty strongly about doing that in my games, you know. So, or even if it's like an adventure where I've said, oh, I've got this really cool thing coming for this character. Or, okay, here's one of my favorite examples. There was a character who really wanted to switch and had this like glorious death planned for his paladin. I won't get too far ahead.
Yeah.
I'm telling you about my game. But anyway.
It sounds awfully familiar to
But like halfway through the adventure, like that he was supposed to die, like, and that's a fairly easy thing to script and work with the player who really wants that. Like someone else's character was just like dying in a combat to get to that moment. I'm like, this would totally steal his thunder, like if somebody else just sort of dies randomly to a monster, you know, and so I kind of like fudge things, you know, like because I wanted to get to this more powerful story, you know. I find that tough as a DM, so I don't know if you have any advice on how to like keep on track.
I think your instincts were dead on there, that if you had talked about this thing in advance with the player, that they're going to go out in this glorious moment. That
don't let the dice roll or someone else's luck go into the
exactly. So I have no problem with that. I would have done the exact same thing.
Yeah.
In the case of my game, just to be very, very brief, Jeff Alvarez, who works at Paizo, is one of the players in my game. And
you mean you guys talk to each other?
We totally talk to each other. We even play games with each other.
Cool.
He had a paladin who died a very, very heroic death. It was awesome. The other players had they didn't have any idea whether it was planned or not. And we sort of kept it that way.
Yeah. That's where it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all my point. It's like your reputation has just sort of been deflated here, I gotta say, you know, like, I expected
well,
like...
Well, here, let me bolster my reputation.
Well,
I have, on occasion, killed a character off while the player was absent.
Oh. Story-wise or mechanically? I mean, someone else was playing this character?
Nobody was... his character was... Usually what happens in my games is... player characters, if the player is absent, their character often just sort of fades into the background. I don't hand that character over to another player because that player doesn't want the responsibility, and if something unfortunate happens, blah blah blah. So characters whose players aren't present just sort of fade away. But on occasion, when the plot serves, I will kill a character off to further a plot point. Case in point, Bruce Cordell plays a tiefling warlock. He was away for a session and kind of went off on his own to do his own thing. At some point later in the middle of the adventure, the characters were sort of regrouping and a bad guy shows up and throws the tiefling's head out in front of them. And for reasons that I won't go into, and the character's just like, oh my god.
somebody needs to text Bruce. His character's dead.
So, like, he didn't even know that was going to happen.
He didn't even know it was going to happen. It was all this sort of kind of a hook, like to kick off the next adventure. And I do things like that periodically. I mean, they had the means to bring him back.
Okay.
That was not really the issue. But it was just the shock and horror of, I can't believe it. Our DM just killed off this character who wasn't even here. And I've done that trick a couple times now. In a recent session, we've got a player who plays a Warforged. And he was absent for a session. His character was still present because we were actually picking up from the session before. And I had an assassin basically just shoot him right through the head with a bolt of slaying and just killed him instantly, just to put the fear of God in the rest of the players. And that went over well. And of course he returned. Now he's wearing an eye patch where he got shot through the eye. And it's precipitated a whole bunch, kind of a whole new conflict. It's added a new layer to that conflict. Characters hate that assassin more than anything.
You killed me, damn it.
You know, that created kind of a cool character concept. Let's say you have a flaky player and he knows he's flaky, so he plays a Warforged, but you invoke the C-3PO trope. So whenever he's not there, he gets blown up in pieces and someone walks him around.
Exactly.
And you talk, like, yeah. And you rebuild it in the next game.
But it all sort of serves the campaign, you know? It's not like I'm being mean. It's not like I have anything particular against the players. So, like, what can I do with the characters in the campaign to make the characters more interesting, to make them more invested, to give them stories and conflicts that sort of help sustain the campaign going forward. Sometimes that means killing off a character. Sometimes it means having a character stumble upon something. Sometimes it means having a character have a relationship with an NPC that's a little bit more interesting or involved than just the guy you're getting a quest from, or just the guy who you have to kill to get to the next level of the dungeon.
Speaking of you know, making the game a better experience, I watched the video cast, the Robot Chicken video cast, and I could see that you put a lot of love in your maps.
Yes.
I even heard through the ether that you were a robot. But the thing is when I looked at your map, it reminds me how much work I pour, you know, drawing mine. I'm not so much a tiles guy, and I will, you know, paint my fingers black drawing maps. So, do you draw them really fast? And do you draw the map after you do the adventure? What do? You do adventure to map or map to adventure?
I do both.
Okay.
It just sort of depends how much time I have. If I have time to plan out the adventure in great detail in advance, I'll draw the map in advance. And then if not, I'll just create it on the fly. I'm fairly good. I've got a bit of a drafting background. So I can come up with really interesting, detailed maps pretty much just on the spur of the moment if I have to. And I've got a very steady hand. I love the finicky details and stuff like that. I want the map to really pull the players into their location. If it's just a square with a door, then they haven't got a lot to play with, and I don't have a lot to play with. So I try to put as much time as I can into a map, but sometimes there's not a lot of time. The tricks I've learned about maps are just to add enough interesting terrain elements that characters have...
they can interact with it.
They can interact with it. There's like some difficult terrain or some hazardous terrain that they have to navigate around, or the monsters have to navigate around, so it isn't just a straight up fight. And then I try to make the location as a little bit distressed looking, a little bit more run down. If you don't have a steady hand, you can still draw awesome maps. The ones I did for the Robot Chicken all had sort of rough-hewn walls, deliberately so, to give the place a look of distress and age. Lots of crumbling bits and things like that. Those little flourishes add so much to a map.
So if I was going to ask you the next question, but you partly answered it. If you had three tips to share out to make good-looking maps on the Vinyl board, you would go with... would you go with texture?
I would say, you know, just rough up the walls. Gives the walls some texture. I would, just for visibility, maybe you do a little bit of cross-hatching along the edge of the wall to show which area is solid versus which area is not. Other tips are just adding very simple features to the room that the characters either have to navigate around or can use to their advantage. And then the other bit is just make sure there's enough space on the map so so that the encounter has room to play out. A lot of small, tightly packed rooms and corridors don't actually make for a very fun or interesting encounter.
Agreed, agreed. I've recently played a game at a con, and the main room was a temple with each, I don't know, about 20 by 10, and all the players loved it. It was a solo fight, and the monsters were going all over the place. It was really cool.
Great.
It's a good tip. All right, well, it was really interesting talking to you.
Yeah,
Now, we know that although you're not that much of a killer DM, you do have a line that you follow.
Yes.
That's a very good tip. And
I should mention that...
I knew you would do
this. Yeah, he's defending his reputation now. It's on the line.
All right.
Not at all. But you mentioned at the start of this podcast that the Will Wheaton experience.
Yes.
The death of ALFL and the profound impact this has had on the gaming community. I'm so sorry to everyone. But it wasn't my fault. Occasionally players will just do wacky things, and sometimes they're rewarded and sometimes they're not. Poor ALFL. We'll be reuniting Acquisitions Incorporated very soon.
Ah, cool.
And we'll see what happens. What are the consequences of that last podcast session?
We'll be looking forward to this. And you'll always have players who will, once they know they made a bad tactical decision, will decide to go with their role-playing drive, whatever.
And I commend that. I absolutely commend that. I welcome players who make deliberately bad decisions because that's what their characters would do. I wish there was more of that.
I agree.
But and you know, the whole AOL story, like, people are talking about it, people are remembering it. If you just, like, you know, managed to, like, if he just turned and ran after he saw all that stuff going, like, we wouldn't have these stories, no one would be talking about
it.
So.
But it's fodder for the next one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, so once again, Chris Perkins, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that was our talk with Chris Perkins. As you can see, his reputation's maybe a little overblown. I mean, he definitely tried to defend it there at the end after we called him on it a bit, that maybe he wasn't so killer because he doesn't have all the body count. But still some great tips, and it's a really interesting guy to talk to about DMing stuff.
Oh, he is the man. Alright, well, this concludes our fifth episode of the Dungeon Master Guys. As usual, we're always open to your questions, be them by email or through phone. Newbie, can you refresh our memories about those possibilities?
Yeah, you can reach us on the voicemail line at 305-349-3026. That's 305-349-3026. And Dave, what's our email address?
dmg@critical-hits.com.
Alright, well, I want to thank our sponsors, Obsidian Portal, for supporting us, and I want to thank you, the listeners, for tuning in for every show. I hope you enjoyed it. Dave, Newbie, have a great one, guys.
See you later.
Thanks.